Oh. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 17 of Christian History and Ideas. I'm John Coleman, and I'm joined by Dr. Nirmal Das. Welcome, Dr. Das.
Great to be here, John. Always a pleasure.
Great. So we are we're in our double digits and we're plowing along, and one topic leads to another. And, you know, we began the year hot and heavy with some modern theses about, I would say, revisionist takes on gospel claims. We took things through the 19th century. We even touched on modernity and different strains there in the high summer. And then we've continued through this year of grace, 2020, looking at certain of the patriarchal sees from the early church, such as in this order, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. That has spurred us on to a meditation on the pilgrimage concept in early Christianity, something which itself would continue. And very much in that same vein, we continue our discussion, really orbiting around this physical aspect of the religion, as we discuss in this recording, relics. So is there anything you would like to interject, Dr. Das, or should we go into a definition?
Let's do the definition and then we can get into the discussion itself. Yeah.
Okay. So the text that we're using just to get the gears going is a book, which I will cite in the description of this recording on BitChute and on YouTube. And all you Colleens and Boogaleens will like and subscribe and this sort of thing and comment, interactive viewing is a better way to digest this material. So our text is Charles Freeman's writing, I believe from 2011, Holy Bones, Holy Dust, subtitled How Relics Shaped the History of Medieval Europe. And the definition he provides for us is this, and this comes from the introduction, and the text is called the preface. There is no proper introduction. In classical Latin, he says, the word reliquae refers specifically to the physical remains or ashes of dead human beings, but by the end of the 6th century, in the dialogues of Pope Gregory the Great, for instance, it was used in this sense to include everything from the foreskin of Jesus discarded at his circumcision, the hair or milk of the Virgin Mary, the bodies of the apostles, but also anything that may have been associated with them, their clothes, for example, or even any object that had touched them, brandera, as they were known. The instruments of the crucifixion, the cross itself, or the lance that had pierced Jesus's side might appear to have been contaminated by their role, might appear to have been contaminated by their role in the killing of the Son of God, but they too were assumed to have a sacred power. And perhaps at this point, it would also be appropriate just in terms of getting things going and getting our mind in the right spot, also to include a related quote, this from a divine author. and we have Acts 19, verse 12, and I'm going to throw it over to Dr. Das now that we have some text to work with. So in Acts 19, verse 12, that when the face cloths or aprons that touched St. Paul's skin were applied to the sick, their diseases left them and the evil spirits came out of them. All right. So with that, Dr. Das, let's take it from there.
Great. So let's go back and look at this definition of the relic. And as you rightly point out, you know, it is part and parcel of this concept of holiness. But what's important here, I think, that we need to look at and keep in mind is that when we are talking about a relic, we're talking about something that has an aspect of holiness attached to it. And I've written down a very interesting quotation from Gregory of Tours, and he calls a relic a touch of paradise. And that concept of something physical that has been left behind in the on the earth, in the world, as a representation of holiness, of connection to the divine, to God, and as a reminder of, to all of us of what is possible for us. So a relic is not, is first of all, it's a historical object, i.e. it is, you know, part and parcel of a holy human being. Theologically, it reminds us of the possibility of salvation. And secondly, what it does is that it helps us understand that those that are redeemed and have gone on to God in paradise have also existed on the planet, on earth, and they went through this process of living in life and arrived at their salvation through a certain kind of process. And by linking up with them through their relic, through a memoria, this is what this is, a memory of them, by linking up with their memory through a physical object, we can also then go through this process. Also, more particularly, relics become that place, physical place, the loci, the locus, where the divine can play out, for lack of a better term, that where the divine can enact, that's a better way of saying it, where the divine can enact miracles or holiness. So what then the relic becomes is a very particular location of that enactment of holiness or enactment of miracle. And this then will lead us into this whole concept of what a relic is and what it does and so forth. But that's a good thing to keep in mind, I think, as well, as you know, as an addendum to what you read, which is that we have this concept of holiness remnant on the earth, on in the physical world that we can touch, we can look at, and so forth. And I think that that concept of association of the human with those departed is very essential. And I think it's a very crucial one to Christianity, as we will look at it a bit later on. So I would add that, you know, I would add Gregory of Tours' concept of an object touched by paradise.
And this concept of the relic is one which touches on this topic, which we've touched ourselves upon in various ways this past year of recordings, and that is the fundamental difference of Christianity in that physical aspect. And if you consider, if one considers certain, especially certain Eastern religions or this sort of thing, you know, there's a contempt of the body that, and we've even touched on this with certain heresies and so forth within the early church. There's this warring of the spirit and the body. Of course, the New Testament in its way talks about that, but there's this tendency of people without the guidance of grace and so forth to make that an intractable hostility, which is where you get people starving themselves to death and various rigorous practices in India and so forth, where the relic reminds us of this sublimation of the physical.
Yes, exactly. And I think what you're getting at is a very important point. And this is something very interesting historically to look at. And that point is, how are the dead, or how were the dead, and still are regarded, how are the dead regarded in non-Christian cultures? And it's a concept that often is misunderstood because of the history of how we, of the history of ideas, of how we arrived at how we understand what paganism is, or polytheism is, and what Christianity is. And if we look at how the dead are regarded, say in ancient paganism, they are seen as somehow polluting. The dead are never held up in any kind of respect. There was a special class of human beings who handled the dead. The others would not handle the dead because it was considered to be polluting. And of course, that concept was that if you did this sort of thing, you would become, you would become polluted yourself, which by that, by then extension meant that you could kill yourself, i.e. by touching the dead, you invited death into your own living body. So there was an abhorrence of anything dead. And like I said, there were special classes. And in the Roman world, interestingly enough, it was quite common practice, especially among the poor who couldn't afford funerals, to simply throw out the dead, to leave them by roadsides and so forth, and just abandon them. Just like they did with children, they would abandon unwanted children by the roadside. You could just throw them away. And interestingly also enough, one of the earliest charities that the Christians started, one of the very early ones in the Roman world, was going around early in the morning and collecting these dead bodies for decent burial. So the Christians from the very beginning never had this fear of the dead body that paganism had. And this allows for a different kind of a mindset. Interestingly enough, in all other cultures, the dead are always placed outside the cities, never within. The dead are always to be left outside. And remember as well, let's not forget that in the Roman world, in the Hellenistic world, most of the people burned their dead. It was cremation was practiced. So the body was gotten rid of within 24 hours very quickly. And the Jews, of course, still do that. They bury the dead very quickly within 24 hours. There was no process where the body was handled, loved, venerated, any of those sorts of things that we take and that we imagine, people doing. They didn't do that. The body
was... just by way of lacuna, I get the impression from my readings in Roman history, I've not specifically looked at it, it's just come up in my study, but I get the impression the Romans would tend to, over the centuries, almost seem to go back and forth between burial and cremation, burial and cremation. Is that fair to say?
The Romans didn't bury at all. It was always cremation. Burial doesn't come into the picture until the Romans become thoroughly Christian. So it is thoroughly cremation that we're talking about. The Romans and the Greeks, did cremate their dead. So suddenly you don't have a dead person around. You've gotten rid of the body. And why cremation happened is a different topic we can get into some other time. But the important thing is that the Christians didn't have this fear of the dead. And therefore, they could handle all of this this problematic aspect of the Roman world quite easily, i.e. what do you do with the dead? Normally, most Romans just threw out the dead people. It was like garbage. You just got rid of them. And that was that. Throw them out by the roadside. But for the Christians, it wasn't that at all, because there is this entire theology of the dead that the Roman world doesn't possess. And this, I think, leads us into this other interesting aspect of that we can get into later, maybe even now, is this idea that somehow venerating a relic is creeping paganism. It's paganism that has crept into a pure kind of Christianity. and it has corrupted it. And so people have become more paganized, the more relics and saints and things, et cetera, that they have. So there was a pure aspect of Christianity in which there were no relics, no saints, nothing, was just pure the faith. And then over time, as people became more and more Christian, they brought all their pagan habits of mind with them. And this inherently changed or corrupted Christianity into, you know, relic venerations, relics and whatnot, and, you know, saints, et cetera, et cetera. All of those examples usually cited as corruption of the Christian faith through pagan influence. And this is a very strong narrative, as you know, in our time. This is how most people are explain religion, but and especially Christianity. But that's simply not true. And we can get into that, you know, a little bit later on as to why that is not true.
I think some of the difficulty with modern relics actually brushes up to a lot of the discussions we had, I would say, around episodes 5 and 6, where we're talking about distortions that happened to Christianity in the West, both Catholic and Protestant Christianities, during and in response to the Enlightenment and interpersonal controversies. And what that's left us with is a very denuded, even for the devout, a very denuded Christianity compared to before the 19th century and certainly before the Reformation, where things are, and for various reasons, that trend has sped up, where a lot of the religion is very just abstract, it's just ideas. There's not that physical aspect. And there are certain things that have happened even within the last year that have increased that lack of the physical aspect of Christian ceremony, sacramental sacraments, and this aspect where the religion is, over the past several generations, just become more and more just a compendium of ideas. And so that is why I would say we moderns have such a, even if we accept relics, we have such a curious relationship with them corporately now.
Sure. And I think we can trace this habit of mind, this way of thinking, back to the 18th century. And this is where this understanding of what religion should be becomes entrenched. And it's the doing, for lack of a better term, of the Scottish philosopher David Hume. In his book called The Natural History of Religions, which comes out in 1757, in that he clearly lays out the approach that we still use whenever we talk about religion, and especially when we talk about the difference in the two types of Christianities that are still prevalent in our day, the Catholic and the Protestant. And of course, Hume is coming at it from the point of view of of the Enlightenment, and that is, you know, happening at this time in the 18th century. But the point is that he is using reason to describe it. We won't get into critiquing Hume, but let me very briefly give you an idea of what he does in this book called The Natural History of Religions. And what he does is that he sets up a two-tiered system in which he has this elite kind of concept of Christianity, which the Protestants always called the pure kind of Christianity, one that is based on sola scriptura, scripture alone sort of thing. And Hume then says this was opposed always by a vulgar kind of understanding of the faith, of any faith. And so what he does is that he says that the elite were always monotheistic, and the vulgar, the ordinary people, were always polytheistic. And since there are more, always more of them than of the elite, it was always the polytheistic tendencies, traditions that tended to dominate and overcome the elite, the pure. So you have basically this idea of corruption from the bottom up going into the elite. So Christianity was pure and good and what it was, et cetera, as described by the early Protestants. And then as more and more people became Christians from pagan backgrounds, i.e. the common people, they brought with them all these corrupting influences, which crept into the purity of Christianity and made it become what it is. So this is David Hume that is, you know, writ large in our understanding of faith and of Christianity. But historically, it's simply, it's a great idea philosophically, but historically it's simply not true. There is no way that people held on to paganism in such a way that profoundly changed the faith to become what it is. In fact, you know, people who study early Christianity, you know, the top ones is the top one is the historian Peter Brown. I think he's in Princeton. They've shown, the study's shown that early Christianity was always about shrines and relics. You know, there was never a time when the Christianity did not have relics and shrines. In fact, the very notion of a shrine and relic is Christian, adopted then by the other religions and other faith systems. It's an influence very widely spread throughout the world, but its origin point is not paganism. Its origin is Christianity. And so historically, we cannot back up David Hume. Unfortunately, he has very deep influence. I mean, he has basically restructured our minds to think this way. And this is, of course, also part of Gibbon, you know, who comes, 30 years later or so, and writes The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And in that, Gibbon, of course, traces this this conflict between the elite and the vulgar or the people. And he traces that and says, aha, this is why the Roman world fell, because it was Christianized, i.e. all the vulgar elements of the Roman society took over Rome. And of course, the elite disappeared with their pure concepts based upon reason. So the 18th century looked back on the Roman world from a very Enlightenment point of view. So for them, the perfect human being was the rational, reasonable 18th century human being who reasoned his way out of everything. And anything that was unreasonable became labeled as superstition. And notice how familiar these terms are for us. We still use that logic all the time. We always talk about, let's not get too superstitious, let's leave superstitions behind, and let us use reason. This is pure Hume, this is pure Gibbon. This is not anything to do with trying to properly understand what happened in the early years of Christian growth and Christianity. And some historians even contend that Christianity would not have grown as fast as it did if it weren't for the relics and the shrines. They are the crucial component of the spread of the faith, because without it, you know, you don't have the reach that a faith normally would have. So, you know, we have to be very careful with our critique, because unfortunately, we're still stuck in that enlightenment, as you pointed out in the beginning, we're still stuck in that enlightenment mode of thinking. And it's been such a profound influence on us that we cannot get beyond it in our understanding. And we must, if we are really to understand truly the truth of what happened in history, and then the truth of what the faith is even today, and what this, you know, what this entails. I think, therefore, relics help us understand this disparity. So I would suggest we let go of this two-tiered system of, you know, this corrupting polytheism and this pure elite who understood it and then got corrupted because a lot of these guys came in and became Christians. Let's abandon that model, because that's not what happened in history. And that's not what early Christianity or even modern Christianity really is all about. It isn't about keeping something pure that is from being corrupted by polytheism or by paganism and all that, these forces. That's a non-starter when it comes to faith and religion. We're talking about something else here. So let's abandon, I would suggest, Hume's dichotomy, Hume's system, Hume's mode of understanding faith, because faith works very differently than how he understood it, clever as it is in the 18th century, and learned as it is. I mean, it is a brilliant book. I don't want to put it down. It's a wonderful book, and people should certainly read it and read it closely. But its paradigm, its structure, we cannot extract and apply to the Roman world and to early Christianity, and to help us understand relics as a hangover of paganism. This is the usual method of explaining things, that this, or the pagans did it and the Christians just brought it in or stole it or something. You know, they always have these terms that help us explain, but that is not a way to look at it at all.
I'd like to interject some thoughts here, and then perhaps revisit this larger topic. But you know, it occurs to me regarding relics and the doubts about relics and so forth, a parallel that I'm perceiving, and I'd like you to respond to it in the history discipline. People who are fans of the liturgy will know that in the mid 20th century, the Latin Church altered many or all of its ceremonies and so forth. And one of the areas which took a blow was the cult of the saints and the sanctoral cycle and so forth. And one of the reasons for that isn't actually hostility towards the saints in say, which I think in kind of a pop discourse, it's interpreted the massive increase of ferial days, for instance, in the calendar of the late 20th century. But it actually has to do with the way people were trained historically. And so I'm going to set this up in the 20th century and throw it back to you, Dr. Doss, in the 18th or 19th century and see if you perceive a similar thing happening. You know, people from the early first part of the 20th century, we'll say, which would have been the generation of the Second Vatican Council experts, were trained in a certain sort of historiography where only predominant authority was given to written texts. And if you cannot follow a certain chain of written texts, it has to be written, right? Because this is the modern world and everything must be written down. And it gets into these dynamics, which you often see with actually scriptural discussions as well, that people don't understand, you know, oral dominant and written dominant cultures. But I wonder if the same, so what ends up happening is a lot of the miracles attributed to saints are brought into question in the mid 20th century officially. And I argue that it's not actually hostility towards them. It's just, it has to do with certain flaws in historical training, of which by the late 20th, 21st century have been somewhat remedied in terms of the data points that historians will consider are much broader, including oral tradition, which seemed actually to inform a lot of the earlier saint stories. So we're back to where we started, like so many things. But do you perceive, Dr. Doss, that was all a setup for this point, do you perceive a similar thing affecting a lot of the Enlightenment writers, even into the 19th century, where they cast doubts on relics? You know, I'm sure we've all heard the jab, there's enough splinters of the true cross to make Noah's Ark and whatever. Is it a matter of the era that obviously the historians of the 18th and 19th century often had the same prejudice towards hard written documentation and other things were of a secondary importance?
Yes, and this is part of that dynamic. And you're right to point out that this is actually a fault of historical training that this has happened, where the faith now needs to conform to historicity. This is historicism gone nuts, you know. And what this is basically David Hume and Gibbon. Their shadow looms very large in historical studies, especially of early Christianity and the early days of church growth. They're basically the determining a lot of this stuff. And interestingly enough, and this is a topic we can maybe discuss some other time, this whole idea of neo-paganism, that is coming up is largely and only through the lens of Hume and Gibbon, i.e., there was, they reversed the tier. So there was, a purity in the people and their faith, which is polytheism, which is corrupted by this oncoming elite system of the Christians. So the Christians are the elite, like Hume says, and the vulgar are the, the people are the vulgate, the ordinary human beings who are pure in their faith, in their, many gods and all that sort of thing, are happy in that. And then this Christians, like this dark force, come and, glom on to the people and destroy them and corrupt them. So it's Hume, it's a very tragic thing in a way, how we have become imprisoned by this very simplistic understanding of history, created by one man in 1757, in his book, The Natural History of Religions, created in one book. And this book has come to dominate how we think about faith, period. And this dominance, as you rightly point out, is now finally beginning to crack. And it's now beginning to be questioned and hopefully done away with. But it has done a lot of damage and it has created a lot of spin-off religiosities, spin-off faiths, for lack of a better term. A lot of people, follow this, and it's a very logical, reasonable approach. I mean, you have to, Hume is a brilliant thinker. There's no denying that at all. But even brilliant thinkers can be wrong at times in their analysis. And he is a man of his time in that regard, because he understood history in a certain way, or tried to understand history in a certain way, but that approach no longer holds. So yes, this dominance or predominance of the text, written text, it's sola scriptura, of course. This is the logic of it. It's like the written text alone matters, nothing else matters. And this is where, all of this Enlightenment force is coming from, this idea of sola scriptura, the book alone determines. Very famously, Jacques Derrida, the post-structuralist philosopher, French philosopher, very famously said, there is nothing outside the text. And that's the logic that we're applying here. And this logic goes back, in a way, to the Enlightenment and Hume. And this idea that only the written matter, the text, everything is text. If you remove text, you have meaninglessness. There's nothing there. You have nothingness, chaos. So this idea that every aspect of life, and this is getting to be the part of the tyranny that we're now experiencing, that every aspect of life is determined by some text, whether that text is medical authority, whether that text is, some other kind of authority that we can appeal to and rely on to govern ourselves. So it's Hume run rampant in a way, sadly. And this has infected everybody. I mean, even Cardinal Newman very famously said, we got to be really careful and clean out the faith from paganism, pagan influences. I can't remember the exact quotation now, but, we have to keep the faith pure from being corrupted by paganism. So this dynamic this contention, I think what I should point out as well, I just thought of it, where this comes from is Hume assuming that monotheism is not the natural way of people to think. People think in a polytheistic way always, and it's a struggle to become monotheistic. That's a Humean construct that he's given us, and we are really loyal to that. Notice, we still think this way. This is how we understand faith. We assume that people naturally want to be pagans and polytheistic. And it's a hard struggle to get them to be monotheistic. And this is not, of course, historical or anything like that. It's not faith even. It's Hume. Hume has given us this idea, and we've latched onto it, with a lot of tenacity. And that idea hasn't gone away. In fact, it has informed so much of our religious life that it's not easy to get away from it. For example, if we get away from it, a lot of the logic of, say, Protestantism disappears, and it gets called into question. This idea of nothing outside the text, sola scriptura, gets, you know, called into question, etc. You know, so the struggle here is, how do we overcome Hume? I think this is the real question we have to ask. And Vatican II and all this sort of thing, that all this that happened was the assertion of Hume, the assertion of the Enlightenment and logic onto the faith in order to keep it correct or pure or whatever the term we might want to use, you know, so it doesn't become something other than what it should be. It's a very interesting dynamic that we're, you know, looking at here. But thankfully, as you also pointed out, it's weakening and it's disappearing.
I want to touch on a vein this is all flowing up against in our second episode. But I also want to give the elbow room on the clock to respond to it. So maybe, Dr. Doss, as we have time for maybe one final point, you know, in the next 8 minutes or so, one of the things that, as you explain this dynamic from the 18th century and the 19th century, one of the things that I'm discerning here is that there's an incorrect approach to a text, arguably springing from the 15th or 16th century and errors there, but certainly by the 18th or 19th century where the text is king, we'll say, or the text is all that matters, as Jacques told us. And so what that produces is it's a terrible spiral, almost like a plane out of control. What that produces, it seems to me, is, again, a very denuded and just completely ideal Christianity where it's just in one's head. And then in the 20th or 21st century, you mentioned the neo-pagan attempts of revival and so forth in various cultures, Norse culture and Celtic and so forth. I'm not too familiar with Southern European attempts of the same, I've not looked into it either. But in any case, it would seem to me a lot of the neo-pagan revivals, as well as this blob of doctrines called the New Age, what they're trying to address, it would seem, in my favorite word, ham-fisted, in a most ham-fisted fashion, is a very denuded Western spirituality now, where it's all just argumentation and intellectuality, and they're perceiving, and this is touching the much, much bigger question, which we'll save for the next episode, but on a somewhat closer time span to our own, we can finish it on this idea that they are perceiving this physical aspect and this larger aspect to religion and worship than just the mind. And this leads to things. I just saw a documentary, so my mind's all in the New Age thing again. It was on called Breatharianism.
Don't know it.
Where people think they can get their nutrients just from breathing and looking at the sun. But a lot of that, the point is, and I'll put a sock in and throw it back to you, a lot of it seems this is a reaction towards a totally empirical and discursive religiosity. So people go to the opposite end, and next thing you know, you're up at 6 a.m. watching the sun, just breathing air, thinking you're getting breakfast.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And what you know, what you're getting at is this idea of the text run wild. You know, it's like everything is, like you said, intellectualized. And not just intellectualized, but hyper-intellectualized. In a way, it's Plato gone nuts, you know? It's Plato's ideals just gone nuts. This idea of the ideal is now, unfortunately, a tyranny. It's become a tyranny. And it's something I think even Plato couldn't understand or didn't understand. But what has happened is that we have become so hyper-idealizers, idealizers of that we live in so enclosed, such enclosed worlds, cut off from so many kinds of realities, you know, where, you know, with the screen, you know.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's Plato right there. It's your Plato's wall. And this year we've seen, just on that one front, we've seen everyone, at least in the West, just sucked into the screen, into the wall.
Exactly, exactly. And we're back in the cave, you know. We are back in the cave. And that is what the neo-pagans are rebelling against. What's that term? What's that very famous book? Archaeofuturism, a French writer. And in it, it's actually a really good novel. People should read it. It's a dystopian kind of future, you know, science fiction future kind of novel. But in it, that's exactly what he talks about. This idea that, or this understanding, I should say, I should get away from using idea, but this understanding that life is far more than just an intellectual exercise, you know? Life is not simply sitting around talking about stuff forever and, you know, not getting anywhere. There we go, Guillaume Fay. And because of this concept of what life should be, no one seems to know how to answer that question. Like, how do we escape the cave? No one knows how anymore. Christianity used to know how, because it was all about getting rid of the cave and back into reality. This is what relics are all about. Relics remind us of the reality of life, of the, you know, the of the body, and not only its mortality, but its beauty, because its body is venerated as a creation of God. So we've gotten away from all these concepts, from all these important understanding of how to deal and live with reality and live within reality, so that we now live in hyper-realism, where it's so abstract that anything and everything is possible. So anything you can think of becomes reality. So any kind of aberrant behavior is possible and is doable, because we have the technology. We can do this, you know, we can do this and we can do that. It's a very strange kind of tyranny that we're really talking about in the end. But getting back to our topic, relics take us away from the cave. And I think this is the essential point that we should understand. Relics, they are, you know, to use that Latin phrase, pars pro toto. They are, you know, parts that represent the whole. And by looking at a part, we can then participate in a larger whole, which is greater than us, which is what Gregory of Tours called something touched by paradise. So this idea then of relic as a means of escaping this trap, Plato's trap, let's put it that way. I mean, let's be blunt. It is a trap set by Plato. Relics help us escape this this conundrum of corruption, of purity, of trying to achieve something through mental processes only, of hyper-evaluating reason over everything else. All of these problems that modernity has thrown on us, if we look at the reality of relics, of faith, we can then overcome these kinds of problems. And they will become more problematic and more tyrannical the less we understand them. And this is the strange, I think, dynamic of modernity, is that we are inundated with so much and we therefore understand so little. And we then resort to easy manipulation of all kinds of things that we are you know, dealing with. So it's modernity is the cave. We're back in the cave, you know, of Plato. And that is where we need to escape from. And, you know, I'll leave it there. We can, you know, keep going on about this a little later, but that's how I would respond to that. But it's a very interesting topic, and we should certainly talk about, I think, neo-paganism a bit more as to what's going on with that. It's a very interesting force in the modern world right now.
Excellent. Well, this will be a good point to conclude episode 17 of Christian History and Ideas. If you have any questions or show suggestions, or even if you have an area of expertise that's appropriate to our topics here, please write us. And we love getting correspondence at christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com. That will be in the description, along with the book reference that kind of will provide different quotes for this episode. And we will continue this into episode 18. So look below and take a look at that. And also in the down below is a word about apostasis and a word about the apostle. And I will simply invite anyone who's interested in studying to go visit, for the moment, apostasisinstitute.wordpress.com and find out about the college. And Dr. Das, can you tell us a bit about the apostle and what we have on the menu for our reading this month?
Yes, actually, November has been a very dynamic month for the apostle. We've got quite a lot, like 19 articles that are really interesting and people will find very interesting. One of the things that immediately comes to mind is we have one that's very interesting about why people hate the Sacré-Cœur Basilica in Paris. And people, that might come as a surprise to people that there are actually people who want to dismantle and destroy it. So if you think of people toppling statues as something annoying, well, there are people who want to actually destroy this beautiful building. And I encourage people to come and read that article. It's a very interesting one. So that's just one of the highlights. There's also others that are very interesting, like the one by our friend John Coleman on a further ideas on the people and what that implies and what that means within the context of democracy. So I would encourage people to come and have a look at that as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you everyone for watching and do keep your eyes peeled after you like and subscribe to this sort of thing on BitChute and on YouTube. Do at that point, keep your eyes peeled for further episodes and we will in episode 18, keep up our talk on relics and getting out of that old cave. Thank you, Dr. Das.
Thank you. Pleasure, John.